Hey, do you like what we're doing here at Light Pollution News? For the price of a coffee, you can help ensure that this show continues to bring you all the latest updates by becoming a monthly supporter. Monthly supporters help us pay to offset the cost of producing this podcast. For more information, go to lightpollutionnews.com/supporter.
Hi there, it's Bill McGinney with Light Pollution News, and before I begin this little bonus episode, I wanted to just preface why I did the episode. Why it's so bright at night? It's a question, it's an idea, it's a place that we can converse and understand the motivations and what drives people to install lighting, to put in lighting, to utilize different lights, and hopefully open up the book to everyone being able to share ideas, exchange ideas, and we can all walk in one path to making more responsible, more aimed, more directed, more purposeful lighting than we see today. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you have any questions or whatnot, I would love to hear your comments. You can simply email those over to me, bill@lightpollutionnews.com. Thank you and enjoy. Welcome to Why So Bright at Night. This is a periodic show where I sit down and chat with folks who might not be as familiar with the concepts embodying and protecting nighttime environments. And my hope is to facilitate conversation, to help us all walk together to a common goal, that being to mitigate negative consequences of human impacts on nighttime ecosystems and environments. Today, I'm very happy to welcome Jennifer Hooken. Did I get that right? Am I close?
That's okay. You're close. Yeah.
So, Jennifer, I first came across your name in a petition to Stevenage, England, to have new street lights installed in a paved park trail to better facilitate ease of evening and morning commuting.
Yeah, that's about right. So it's to Stevenage Council. That's correct. But it's not necessarily street lights. I haven't specifically asked for street lights. I asked for lighting on the main paths in Fairlands Valley Park, which is a main park in Stevenage. It's right in the center of it.
We'll get into, I guess, lighting in a second. But right now, I want to kind of understand, so listeners can understand, what Stevenage, the town of Stevenage, where it is, you know, what the whole area looks like, and then what the park is used for and what the park looks like. So we do have something in common. I know you're a bike commuter, right?
Yes, I cycle. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Yeah. And I personally love biking. I bike commute as well. And I love it. There's nothing better than being on a bike and being able to, you know, go to where you want to go and stop off where you want to go. And you feel great. You just feel great when you're doing it. Why don't you explain, tell me a little bit about Stevenage. Like, who lives there? How many people live there? Do you guys have like a primary industry, or do most people commute? Do they commute down to London, or was Stevenage England?
Yeah, no, thank you. So Stevenage, I of course I would say this is the best town in England. Of course I would say that. So I actually used to live in London, and I moved to Stevenage only a year ago. So it's actually very close to London, just north of it. So we are in the county of Hertfordshire, which is just north of London. As I said, we have 8 trains an hour that go to London. You can get to King's Cross, that's the Harry Potter station for people who don't know London, in just 19 minutes when you use the fast train. But generally you can get there in under 30 minutes if you use like a slower train as well. So a lot of people, yeah, of course they work in London or they work in Cambridge, like kind of because we're in between. But actually most people work in Stevenage themselves. I looked up the figures, and the Stevenage regeneration scheme that we have going on actually estimates that 50,000 people, local people, actually are employed in Stevenage. And our biggest employer is JSK. So that's a pharmaceutical company. And you think, okay, 50,000, that doesn't sound like a lot. But actually, our town is 89,500 people. So that actually is, you know, a lot. Larger portion of local people are actually employed in town. So Stevenage was the first new town in England. And I'm not sure if, Bill, whether you're familiar with the new town.
Yeah, why don't you explain that concept?
Yeah, so that was a program from the UK government to ease housing pressures after the Second World War. So they literally built new town. So Stevenage, before it was Stevenage, it was, you know, a collection of, you know, villages on the countryside, and they literally created a town from where there was no town before. So plans were drawn up I know the first people moved in 1951, and that was 5 years after the plans were approved. So that was 1946 then that plans were approved. So it's quite a special place, I would say. But it also means that people have thought very long and hard about how to design the town as well. And it means that, you know, when we come to cycling, for example, we have segregated cycling lanes, which were especially in the early days, used a lot by workers to get to and from work. I've been to the local museum. I've seen such cool pictures of like people riding their bikes on the segregated lanes to go, to go to work. And that was until, you know, cars became more popular. So we had a lot of industry, still have a lot of industries around wartime. Stevenage actually produced a lot of weapons as well. But also the one thing that I think is really, really cool about Stevenage is the Mars rover was actually developed and tested in Stevenage, and we still have Airbus as a large local employer as well. Wow. Which I think is a fact that not a lot of people know.
I had no idea. That's great. That's a good little trivia fact right there.
Yeah, and I guess the final thing to say about Stevenage, which is very relevant, I think, to, you know, why you've invited me on, is it is a very urban place, but it has a lot of park and green spaces. So we have, you know, multiple parks, and actually the town was developed and designed with, you know, Stevenage being a public space network as well. So the park itself that we're talking about, Fairlands Valley Park, is actually 2 miles north to south, and then actually the town is kind of around that. So it's that's great, I think.
Yeah, it looks like a very long park, right?
It is, yeah.
So 2 miles north to south. Who uses that park?
Oh, a lot of people. Obviously I use it. We get a lot of commuters using it. So, you know, people who...
Is it like a cut through? Or is it...
Yeah, it is. Yeah. So the park could actually connect three different wards or three different key neighborhoods. We have on the south side of it, we have a retail park where a lot of local people live, but it's also cut through, as you said, towards the town center as well for people living in the north and east side of the town. We have a lot of schools around the park, so it's obviously children, families, teachers who use it. We have a lot of dog walkers coming there.
Always.
We've got the running clubs. Yep. The cycling hub of Stevenage is located in Fairlands Valley Park as well.
Okay.
I spoke to people, like older people who go there for their daily exercise.
Do you have Tai Chi and I guess
We probably do, to be fair. I don't do Tai Chi, so I don't know, but we probably do. I have seen, you know, groups, you know, going there for exercise in like a group, you know, group form beyond running. So we probably do. I'm just not aware of it.
What does the park visually look like? Is it mostly wooded, or do you have football fields? Do you have sporting facilities?
Yeah, so we don't have football fields inside the park. They are like bordering it. There are football fields, but not inside the park. So so it's 120 acres for people who's mind works in that way. Yep. They will understand it's really big. So in the master plan for Stevenage, the proposal was for this park to be the town's principal area of recreation. So there's actually some artificially created lakes as well as green space as well. So we have the north end specifically has a sailing lake for sailing and fishing. There's a trim trail. On the south side, there's a grasshopper trail, wildflower meadow. They plant the Millennium Woods in 2000, like the 1999 to 2000. On the north side, they planted trees and hedges. There's a fountain, there's bird feeders, there's a paddling pool, play area, there's a cafe and studio for community use. So it has a lot. It has something for everyone.
This sounds like a really fun park.
As they would say. I do want to emphasize though, the park, as I said, it's like right in the middle of an urban area. So, you know, it has schools, sports fields, housing, woodlands all next to it. Mm-hmm. And there's also a main road that crosses through the park. So the park is kind of cut into two. You've got the north side and the south side. And there's an underpass for pedestrians and cyclists to kind of pass that main road. And the south side as well is referred to locally as the showground. And the council actually has a premise license for events for that, you know, for that area.
And
as
when the showground, is that just like seasonal festivals or something, or?
Yeah, it's mostly grass, mostly grasslands. Mm-hmm. They have now also planted new new trees there as well. The edges of it, on the edges of site, there's also, like I said, grasslands, a wildflower meadow, and then obviously there's a millennium, there's the millennium wood on the side there as well. I guess the final thing to say on the park as well, which may not be as, I don't know if it's common in the US or not, but when I lived in London, the park's closed at dusk. But this park is 24-hour access, which, you know, just for some cities, that's, or for some cities and towns, that's not common. But, you know, this park has 24-hour access to it.
Right, yeah. In the US, it's hit or miss. Some places, urban parks are typically, I don't know if they're posted, at least here on the East Coast, I don't know if they're posted for not, for no use after dark, but they're 24/7. I mean, everything's pretty 24/7. Now you're not going to have sports usually, like, you know, at like 1 a.m. Right. So, that sounds like a really great park. That sounds like, you know, a great spot for the community. I assume, you know, does the festival area now, does that have lighting?
No, none of it. So the only part of the park that has some lighting, there are two routes on the north side of it that go east to west that have some street lights. And that, I think, was part of a safer route to school kind of network. Mm-hmm. So there's some lights there, but nothing from north to south. And that's only on like two particular areas in the on the north side of the park. That's it. There is one big bright light next to the sailing lake where the boats are stalled, and the light is quite high. And I've been told that's for CCTV of it for the lake itself. But that's about it.
Okay. And you said it's the whole park is abutted by buildings or residential schools and stuff like that. Now when you're in the park, you have a great picture here where you show yourself, I think it was daytime, and then at night with a flashlight down, and the camera wasn't able to pick you up. What are those buildings not spilling light over? Is there ambient light there?
No. The light from the building is kind of blocked mostly by the trees kind of around it. You can see the lights from, say, the stadium. There's a football stadium all the way on the south end. So on the south end, you then have a big road. On the opposite side of the road, there's a big stadium. You can see the billboard lights in the background, or like, you know, far away, but that doesn't light up your, you know, immediate
area. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And I presume you're using like a bike light most of the time you go through there.
Yeah. So it's interesting because, you know, most bikes, when you buy them, they have actually a light, you know, already attached to them. We bought, like my partner and I, we bought lights that you can detach, that we can use them as a flashlight as well. Mm-hmm. So they're a little bit more expensive. They're not top range or anything. They're kind of like middle range. So they are definitely, I would say, brighter than most standard bike lights. So yeah, that's the one that we've used for that picture that you were referring to.
Okay, I got you. Okay, so this new park, well, I guess the additions that they put in the park, it sounds like you have a bit of recreational opportunities, but you also have, sounds like they're also trying to cater to some of the insect population there. You have some certain plantings, certain trees and whatnot. Are you aware of any like birds that you can commonly see in there, or other mammals that, like foxes or anything, that typically reside in there?
Oh yeah, we definitely have foxes. I think that's the standard in the UK, in our towns and cities. We have, you know, we have foxes. I've heard owls as well.
Oh wow, that's great.
Difficult word to pronounce. I've heard them. I've not seen them. We have a lot of geese coming around.
That's everywhere.
tennis everywhere, I think. You know, we have common ducks, squirrels, obviously. We got the American squirrels or the grey squirrels here. We got some swans as well, which are fairly common, I think, in UK parks. And then, of course, we have that grasshopper area as well that I mentioned earlier. It's interesting because Stevenage actually has a biodiversity strategy, which is very unique for UK councils to have a biodiversity strategy. But Fairlands Valley Park isn't mentioned in it. So I don't actually, I was trying to find more information on it, but unfortunately, I don't. I don't have that information other than what I've observed myself and what I've heard from other
seen,
people.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So you touched on this earlier. There's other parks in the community. And now what do these parks look like? Because these are ones that close at night. What do they look like? They're smaller parks?
I'm sorry.
I misunderstood. That's my fault.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're also open. So it's a mix, really. A lot of it is, you know, just empty kind of green space with some, you know, some trees and shrubs, and some do actually have football fields in them. The majority, actually, the main lane or path that goes through it actually has lights.
Okay. You know, so do the other ones typically have lights? Okay.
Yeah, they do on the main path, not lighting up the whole grass field. Right, that's not the case. Just the path. It has some lights to it. Unfortunately, Fairlands doesn't.
Okay.
At least not north and south.
Right. Right. Okay. Do you know what kind of lighting is? Do you know if it's shielded? If it's just like a light that's aimed on an angle? Typically you can tell, now I'm going to use my bias here.
That's okay.
I can tell what I consider good lighting and bad lighting if I notice the light. So if I don't notice the light, typically in my mind, that's good lighting because I don't even know it's there. I'm not having a visceral reaction to the light. Do you know about how those lights look?
To me, they look like standard street lights. Mm-hmm. And I know that in the UK generally, but also in Hertfordshire and therefore in Stevenage, because interestingly, the cycle lanes and our roads, they fall under highways, therefore they're county managed, not Stevenage Borough Council managed. It gets really confusing.
Yeah, of course.
So they are your standard kind of street lights that you would see. And I know that there is an intention for them to, what's that called? Where they reduce the brightness of the lights, you know, during the night or earlier in the morning. And there's been a kind of a push generally for that.
Right.
So I imagine that would happen, you know, to those street lights as well. But I can't say for certain because I haven't been in the park at 4 a.m.
So Stevenage itself, how would you classify, like, how dark is it really at night in Stevenage? Can you see about 100 stars? And I say 100 stars because 100 stars is usually where we have something called a Bortle scale. And a Bortle scale goes from 1, which is like, it's very, very dark, to 9, which is daytime at night. And here I live in a Bortle 8, where if I go out at night, like, I'll be honest, I don't need a light. If it's cloudy, it's like it's a full moon out there because all the light's reflecting off the clouds. How would you say, where does it sit in that regard? Are you able to talk about that?
Yeah, I've tried to pay more attention to it recently, and especially since starting the petition as well. I've purposely gone to the park at different days when there's more clouds or fewer clouds as well, just to see the difference. The first thing I would say on it is, obviously, having moved from London to Stevenage, you know, you can definitely see more stars than you can in London. It was the first thing when we moved to our house, and I was for the first time in our garden at night, and I looked up and I was like, "Whoa, I can actually see stars!" Wow. But I wouldn't go as far as to say that I can see 100. Potentially on a clear, you know, on a clear night, you could definitely get above 50. I would say, but I can also recognize what you said. When it's cloudy, it looks like there's a kind of almost like a full moon, because when it's cloudy at night, it just looks like white.
Yep, all the light is reflecting.
especially in the park, because you, what I imagine you get is a lot of reflection from, I mean, in addition to light pollution, we have a lot of noise pollution as well because of the cars that pass through the park because of Six Hills Way. That's the road that cuts through it. But also on the west side of the park, we have Fairlands Way, and there's a lot of cars there as well. Okay. So we have obviously a lot of reflection from the car lights as well as the street lights from those streets. And of course, we have the retail park on the south end, and of course, the general residential area. So we do have a lot of, you know, light pollution obviously going up that isn't necessarily from the park, obviously.
Right. I mean, especially car headlights these days. Car headlights are so bright. And, you know, like, it's hard to drive sometimes because you get blasted.
Yeah, I've noticed that as well on the sides, like when I use cycle lanes, and obviously it's segregated, but it doesn't mean that there's like a physical barrier between the cycle lanes and, you know, the general road. And when there's cars coming towards you and you're going the other way on your bike, you get blinded.
Yes.
You know, the car is actually coming towards you. So, yeah, no, we've definitely noticed that. But yeah, so I would say obviously the lights or in terms of, you know, that kind of dark skies feeling, it's definitely better than in London. But it's not as great as I've seen it in North Devon, for example, when I was on holiday there. So, we definitely don't have what I would say dark skies and sea.
Okay. Yeah, we might have the same skies. We might.
Sounds like we might actually.
I can definitely agree. I've been there where you have oncoming cars and you're trying to just, it takes a recovery time. It takes seconds. Okay. It takes quite a while. And I know we're going to get into this because we're going to talk about the actual lighting of the park. One of the things that you're concerned about is, you know, people tripping or hitting something. I don't know how your paved park roads or paved park trails are over there. Over here, just given the geography, given the location we're at, you know, we have weather that will freeze, thaw, and the actual path may not be whole per se. So, you know, that's a concern, right? Like, you don't want to have your tire dip into that and then you go flying off into a tree. So why don't you explain to me what's needed? Why do we need the lights in this park?
Yeah, so I think my best way of explaining it is how I, you know, kind of first explained the situation to the council before I even started the petition. I actually asked the council a question during the council meeting. And after that, I actually had a meeting, like a walkabout of the park together with the council, a councillor and a council officer as well. So I think the best way is to explain it as I explained it to them. So when most bicycle lights, for example, they're in one position, I can adjust mine as I've explained. So if I shine forward, I can see my surroundings up to a meter. But if I shine downwards, I can actually see the roads with its bumps. So we have similar situation to you in terms of the quality of the surface isn't great. And that's, you know, being polite about it. But even though I know the lanes really well, so you could say, oh, you know what, I know the lanes well, so I don't need to shine down. I can just shine forward so I can just, you know, see my surroundings. Actually, I still get caught out. I still get caught out, you know, by surprise by the turns, and I often miss turns actually, but also by the bumps in it as well. So the lanes aren't in such a state that you can actually cycle them without them being lit. They're not flat. They're not as well maintained. Also, Stevenage is hilly. I just mentioned the name of the road that crosses through Fairlands Valley Park. It's called Six Hills Way. It probably gives you an impression of what Stevenage is like. It's not flat like Philly, as you just said. Actually, it has inclinations, it has turns, which makes it even more tricky. And especially in autumn and winter, which are really the months that we're talking about here, there's leaves on the path. There's no clear edge, you know, for the path or where the grass starts. It just gets slippery. And it's not only when you're on your bike, it's also when you're walking as well.
Right.
Or if you're in a wheelchair, it's not easy to see the edges of the path or to see your surroundings. And I've had very often that I'm either walking or cycling, someone is coming towards me, I'd not noticed it until I'm literally passing them because you can't see each other.
Right. Yeah. And especially if you have oncoming bikers too, again, you have that glare issue. And what kind of, I guess, what is the perfect situation? What are you looking for at the most basic level from Stevenage? What would you like to see in the park?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's very difficult for me to give you like any, you know, technical details of what kind of lighting we would like to see. The petition ask was very, was clear in the sense that we asked for, you know, eco-friendly, wildlife conscious lighting along the park's main pathways and access points that are not lit yet. Specifically,
I want to pause you on that right there, because I think that is phenomenal that you're considering eco-friendly, wildlife-friendly lighting. That idea of like an eco approach and considering the environment, saying environment first, and then this is what we need to facilitate a safe passage. In my mind, I love that. And that's such a great approach to this. But continue along. I didn't mean to fully cut you off.
No, thank you for recognizing that. But yeah, that's been our starting point all along. And it's been from the moment I first asked my question to the council back in October 2023, I made it very specific, saying, you know, even knowing that there's wildlife-friendly, eco-conscious options available, what will the council do? And obviously then I realized I need to show that there's a wider community need. And that's why I started a petition to kind of demonstrate that. So yeah, we asked for that specific type of lighting along the main pathways and access points. Now, I'm not a lighting expert at all. And I'm also not a wildlife expert. So really what I'm asking the council now is to consider all options and make a business case and an assessment that balances that community need with the need to reduce light pollution and protect wildlife, and really get that professional advice from the start on things like what I've now learned about, you know, soft or blue light or how bright things should be. About, I think your latest podcast talks about 2,500 Kelvin, I believe, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, usually the ask is 2,200. And
2,200.
And then 2,700 is kind of like, okay, if we have to. 3,000 is a little higher, but
things like that. Yeah, yep. So specifically getting advice on those particular points is really what I'm asking the council, because I can't be expected to know, you know, all of this. I'm a resident. You know, so, but also things like,
you'll be shocked. They probably don't know any of it. So
that's the ask, is to get those experts involved from the start, you know, how long they should go on, whether there should be motion sensors involved, everything, you know, all the different options. And then what I'm working on now with the council is, then looking into, okay, informing and testing, you know, pulling together a group of consultees. So it will be people who supported the petition, because the petition was supported by community organizations. So Cycling UK Stevenage, the local branch, supported the petition. We got two local running clubs who supported the petition. We have local businesses who supported as well because of their workers. We'd love to get schools involved as well, you know, families and young people to get involved. But also there are some statutory consultees that the council needs to look at. So they need to involve the Wildlife Trust from the start. They need to involve the police from a community safety point of view as well. They need to consult those. And then the other thing that we're asking is look into research that has been done around how kind of lighting affects accessibility for cycling specifically, but also for parks and green spaces. And one of the things that I've found is there has been research into cycling participation, and that has shown that a minimal amount of lighting can actually significantly increase an uptake of cycling. And there's actually a point where if you do any more lighting, the impact on participation is like negligible. So why would we? And that's the kind of considerations that I want the council to look at.
Jen, that's great to hear. I've always thought that. So I never actually looked it up. But I've always thought that, just going around, because here we have major thoroughfares that have 4,000 Kelvin lighting and they're very bright. And the brightness level, it lulls you into a daytime malaise. And I don't know if that makes sense to you as a biker, but like in the daytime malaise, you're kind of going through and you're kind of like, you're not really actively paying attention as much as you would if it was dusk, right? Where you're forced to pay much more attention. And if you keep the light level low, then you have more visibility and you can also still use your bike light for the purpose it serves. And then when that other light comes at you, it's not going to blind you as much. And in addition, you are able to gain more domain awareness because your eye, right? Your eye is better adapted at that point than when you go from a bright 4,000, which is essentially almost as close to a white light. When you go from a bright one like that into immediate area where there's no lights, and then you have time, there's a time delay, right? For your eye to catch up. And I think that's a really good point. So I guess one of the questions I have on that, would it be okay? Would you be open if they came back and said, hey, you know what? We like this. We'll put on lights, but we're going to shut them off at 9 p.m. Is that acceptable?
I find that really difficult to say now, to be honest, because on the one end, you know, you can say, you know, yes, of course, because, you know, it will protect wildlife and it will reduce that, you know, light pollution level. But I think there needs to be a really strong rationale for that. And it needs to be, I wouldn't say yes or no at this point, to be honest with you, because I know that there are commuters that have to use the park around midnight to get home. So what about, you know, what about them? And we really do need to consider those people as well. And so what I would ask the council to do, and as part of their assessment, is look at, well, actually, look at this also from a climate change perspective, because we want people to adopt lower carbon lifestyles, is what they call it, what they call it here.
Right.
So that means actually, you know, using more active travel, like walking, cycling, wheeling, or using public transport as well. So actually, if we reduce our, you know, dependency on cars that have that much light pollution as well, and, you know, our dependency on those other main roads where we can then reduce lighting, actually, will that not be a greater benefit than keeping those lights on that are very well thought through for the park for longer? You know, what are the impacts there?
Would you be fine with any cutoff time?
If there's a business, you know, if there's a case for it, if we get a very clear, you know, recommendation back to say, actually, you know, from a wildlife perspective, you shouldn't keep it on after this hour. And if that is in, you know, if that is in balance with what the potential impacts could be on the uptake of active travel, if that has been fully considered, then I will accept that recommendation. But I would always push for, you know, has this been a wider assessment of what a potential uptake could look like of our paths through the park, because it's such an important route through our town.
What about motion sensor lights?
I've seen them used, you know, successfully. So that could be part of the solution. And I know that that's what what I know the council is looking at the moment is what types of lighting generally is available. And then through that, you know, through that consultation work that we will then do is look at, so what could work for all the different types of users, and then look at, you know, it might be a combination of, you know, motion sensors and solar lighting or something else.
Would you feel comfortable?
I don't know what the perfect solution is.
Would you feel comfortable with the motion sensors?
Yeah, I would be. I mean, as I said, if it's part of that considered approach and that considered assessment, then if that is the conclusion, then that is the conclusion. Mm-hmm. And I'm very conscious that even though I personally started this request to the council, I don't want it to be about what I want. You know, I don't want the solution to be a reflection of this is Jen's perfect solution for the park. That would be the worst. That would be the worst outcome, because I now have 1,300 people who signed this petition. We received 1,000 signatures in 2 weeks to the council to say, go and consider this. Mm-hmm. And so the worst outcome would be to be a solution that I'm really, really happy with because it works for my specific circumstances. And then it doesn't work for the families who bring their children to dance classes that take place in the studio next to the cafe, for example. Mm-hmm. That would be terrible. And then they will continue to use their car because they don't feel safe to use the park.
Okay.
I wouldn't be happy with that. I hope that makes sense.
No, that's fine. Yeah. Are you looking specifically at lights that are going to be aimed at the bike path, or do you want it aimed off trail, or?
Definitely on the, like, it would be for the main paths. So for example, what I mentioned earlier, that there is, you know, a grasshopper area. I'm not I'm not suggesting we light up that area. Absolutely not. No, no, no. So what the petition very clearly said and stated, because we had to be very specific in our request, mm-hmm. is along the main paths. So I'm not saying go and light up the play area, you know, at night. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying ask, you know, light up, or not light up, but, you know, provide lighting for the main paths. That's the request.
And you're fine with any kind of, with a lower color, with an amber color?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't have to be. I actually don't really like billboards. So, you know, I'm not asking for floodlights or billboards. Yeah. No, absolutely. And I've also read about what you just mentioned about, you know, it pointing downwards, mm-hmm. as well, and how important that is. And especially knowing that we have owls, for example, you know, right. making sure that the light is pointed downwards. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, that's why I said it's so important to do it from the start with all those different considerations, so that, you know, when the council's engineer comes back and says, oh, great, we can have this floodlight and it will be high and it will light up the whole area, we can then say, no, I'm not saying he would, you know, I'm not saying he would do that. But, right. you know, to have all these considerations right out in the open from the start, it will make us hopefully help us prevent making the wrong decisions.
Okay. Yeah, that's the lighting on the path can be done very easily with LEDs now, because LEDs can be aimed and targeted. And some places have done a phenomenal job just lighting up the path. Yeah. And like you said, you don't, any light really for wilderness, for nature, any light is a pollutant at night. Yeah. It's just like, yeah. you know, yeah. any, right.
Yeah.
So taking that in consideration, especially owls, I mean, it's always great to, it's one of the most fun things to hear is like a screech owl here, where it has like a whinny and when you're outside, and it just adds character to the night. So that's great to hear. It's great to hear that you're really trying to interrogate the idea and trying to find a very equitable solution. And I commend you on that. So I want to ask you about you now, and how do you engage with the night? What do you do? Like, do you go out to dinner, or do you go like, how do you engage? What's a typical way that you actually interact with night, which sounds weird. I understand that.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So actually, I think, again, it comes back to my original question to the council. I explained to them, I'm lucky enough that I can work from home most of the days. I do travel. I do have to travel for work, but the majority of the time I work from home. And that does mean after I've been inside the house, you know, having meetings online and doing, you know, desk-based work, I would like to go out after I finish my day's work. But in autumn and winter, it gets dark so early. And by the time I finish at 5:30, it's dark. And then and even though I live literally 5 minutes away from Fairlands Valley Park, I would not feel comfortable going there by myself to go for a run after work, even though mm-hmm. in summer, spring, that's what I would do.
Right.
So we, like my partner and I, we actually cycle a lot. We don't just cycle to go to and from work. So when I have to take the train, obviously I cycle to the train station. We actually use our bike for everyday kind of journeys. We go to supermarket. We, you know, we've got pannier bags on my bike as well. So you'll often see me, you know, with groceries coming back and everything. So I would say I feel very comfortable going outside in the evenings. And I do that on a very regular basis. Sure, I have days where I don't want to go out and just, you know, crawl up on the sofa with a blanket and a cup of tea. And
yeah, of course.
Obviously, I have those days as well. I have
days and nights I won't do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure, yeah, you know, sure, I do have those. But it's about, you know, it's, yeah, there's a distinct difference to the how I perceive my activities in autumn and winter versus spring and summer. And I know that I'm not the only one in that experience.
Okay. So I want to just quickly touch on the, you don't feel comfortable in a dark environment. And what do you think drives that? What do you think the source, the real, true, honest source is this driving that? I'm very curious. This is a very curious question on my end. I've always wondered. I feel, yeah, no, this, I'm not like that. Right? I love the dark. I love night. I love being out there. So different and so much Anahuac. Like, it's very different. It's a very different experience. So I'm very curious.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think how I explained it to the council, I said it very much from my perspective as a woman. As a woman, I do not feel safe being by myself out in the dark, especially in a park. And I know that a lot of women and young girls have that experience as well. So, for example, Fairlands Valley Park, they are a recognized Green Flag Award winner, which is like a national scheme in the UK for well-managed parks. They have guidance, they have research available, and that shows that actually sexual harassment in public spaces actually affects 71% of women in the UK. And that rises to 86% for women between 18 and 24 years old. That's not to say that, you know, everyone has had that specific experience, but you will know someone potentially who has. You will know that this happens, and therefore you just do not want to take the risk. You just, you know, there's this Sport England in England explains this very well. They have a campaign. It's called This Girl Can. And they last winter, they launched this new campaign about lift the curfew. It's like women and girls, they put this own curfew potentially on themselves because they don't feel safe because of their experience within modern day society.
Why do you feel safer during the day than at night with that? Is there more harassment that goes on at night?
No, the statistics don't show that there's more harassment at night than during the day. It's actually the other way around. But actually, when you look at some of the guidance in terms of how you can make green spaces and parks in particular more accessible, actually it does say having more people there will increase that perception of safety. And having people around you and not being the only one will actually help people feel safer, including women and girls.
Okay, so there's a feeling of safety through it, because during the daytime, which I feel like is much more unsafe than night, especially my experiences during the daytime, seeing a lot of stuff, being victim of at least one thing. Is it rational to be very comfortable during daytime and not comfortable at nighttime? I guess I'm just trying to drill down on what the source drivers. Where is that? Why is it way more acceptable to be afraid at night than during the daytime?
I wouldn't say it's more acceptable, you know, in that sense. You know, what I would say is the fact remains is that women and girls, but also men and boys, you know, because I've had, you know, men and younger men, not boys, because you had to be 16 to sign the petition, but I've had them support the petition as well. But you know, the fact remains, we know that women and young girls, what we were talking about, feel unsafe in these environments, and whether that is a rational fear or not, based on crime statistics, really, in my opinion, doesn't really matter in this position, because we have very clearly identified a need and a concern that society needs to address. Because I don't think it is acceptable that women and girls feel that way, and therefore, the least we can do is accommodate this concern and to mitigate it to the best we can. Now, I'm not saying that lighting will fix all of that. It's not a magical solution. There are, stubborn inequalities, I think, generally in society that will need to be addressed. But lighting goes a long way to actually providing that space for women and girls to be more active. And that will obviously, also encourage other people to use the park. And in this particular instance, that will help with accessibility and inclusivity of the park as well. So it's not fair that that these things happen to women and girls, and fear is their natural response. I hope that clarifies a little bit.
Okay, I've got one last question here. So night is pretty much the endangered half of the day. We're doing everything we can to get rid of it. And, you know, I often joke with people, like, we can go inside, close the shade, go to bed, and light up everything around us like maximum security prison. But animals, insects, anything in the environment cannot. They have to live. Plants, even plants, are affected by it. They have to live in these environments. So going forward, what do you think we can do to limit our impact on night ecosystems while at the same time providing that feeling of safety?
Right. So I think there's two things here. The first of all is education. And that's what I'm really trying to do, you know, with the petition when we're looking at what kind of lighting options would be suitable for Fairlands Valley Park, is really taking into the advice from experts, also looking at developments in technologies as well, and really optimally using that. And being very open and honest about that with the public as well. Like, you know, oh, your request was for lighting, you might expect these really bright, cool as in the color cool, not awesome cool.
Yeah, I gotcha.
You know, cool lights in the, you know, in the park. But actually, we have installed these lights because of X, Y, Z reasons, because these were all of our considerations. So I think that's really important when, you know, we use this as an opportunity to educate, you know, everyone involved in, and including people who weren't involved with the petition, as this is why we've done it. And this is also what you can do at home, for example, when you want to reduce light pollution and when you want to make environments more eco-friendly, really. And I think the second part is to really listen to the people who currently feel excluded and to realize that and respect that people have different experiences. And those experiences are valid. And even if, you know, if fear is a response, then that is not something, it's not as easy to say, like, well, grow a thicker skin, for example. You know, that's not a respectable way, a respectful way to respond to these concerns. And actually, it is talking about, well, understanding why is that fear there? And how can we mitigate some of that fear? And lighting will help mitigate some of that fear in this instance. And then the third thing I would add, sorry, I know I only said two things, but the third thing I would say is, you know, in your description, you said like, oh, you know, we can lock ourselves inside. I don't think that's the solution. I want people to be able to go outside and enjoy it, because the biggest threat at the moment is climate change. And for us, for everyone to take action, is to have that appreciation for our natural world. And we can only do that when we actually go outside and enjoy it. So that's really what I would say to people as well.
Okay, well, great. Well, my guest today has been Jennifer Horkin. Horkin, I get it right this time.
Yes.
Horkin, there we go. Thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it. And I will have your petition link up in our show notes if anyone wants to check out the petition itself. And Jennifer, have a great rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.